Well, hello everyone. I am joined once again by Todd Lewis, big friend of the show, big friend of the channel. He still hasn't shaved his beard off since last we spoke. And I still haven't taken this smoking jacket off or indeed finished this Juan Lepers number one. I've just almost finished, but I've got my next one lined up as a proper, I've got to have two. It's kind of like starter and main course, or main course and pudding, maybe pudding. This is a Paul Oranger, and it has a salted caramel note, so it's probably a dessert, whereas this is the main course. But anyway, Todd, you want to talk today about the sexual marketplace and what its kind of role is in the political system, and how it works, you know, in online politics and so on. So we're going to get to all of that soon. I just have to remind people that Foundations of Shakespeare is soon to come out and is available on pre-order. As I said, I should be giving a talk about that at some point later this year as well. But at the moment, I have my January sale on, which is promo code SHORJAN. If you own the course and you send a receipt for the course to the publisher, they will sell it to you for half price. They wrote me a note the other day saying they've already had lots of people who've done that. So grateful to all of those people. But you too can be one of them. Buy it now. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the sexual marketplace.
Sure. Yeah. Sure, 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 sure. And so, sure.
Sure, Jan.
Can you command a comma like Joseph Conrad?
Sure,
sure, sure, sure, sure, and sure, Jan.
Are you magnificent in your mastery of marginalism like Murray Rothbard?
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
Are you legendary in your logical leveling of lamentable loquacity?
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
Come on down to the January sale at the Academic Agency. Promo code SHORJAN for 25% off. All this January, I got more courses than the Queen had horses.
Sure, Jan.
I got better rates than Andrew Tate's had mates.
Sure, Jan.
I got better deals than Lizzo's had meals.
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
And so, sure, 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 and so, sure.
All right, Todd. What do you mean by the sexual marketplace, and why should we care about it?
Right. So, on the online right, of course, the sexual marketplace has been thrown around a lot, specifically as a term coming out of the manosphere circles. Now, one of the things that I always felt was unsatisfactory about this was that they didn't really define the marketplace, and they didn't really define, no, they talked about what it was like operating inside of it, but they sort of acted like it was just an unchangeable facet of reality. Like, I don't know, you know, the sunset or trees. I'm like, no, this is something that was created, constructed. It didn't normally be like this. And it, you know, used to be different before the sexual marketplace. So what is it? Well, I argue it's a captive market. What's a captive market? Well, in economic terms, that means you have a single or a handful of suppliers, so monopoly / oligopoly, controlling that market, rather than having it as you know, quote unquote, a free market where you have an open entry to anybody. Now, when you look at the sexual marketplace as a market, you have to ask yourself a few things. Okay, well, what goes into it? What defines the market space, and why does it exist as such? Because if we go to the sexual revolution and broader talks about sexuality in the 20th century, it's sold to you as some sort of like liberatory project. You know, don't be a stuffy square. You know, just experiment, self-express, and all that stuff. And they want people to think that ideas are the fundamental driving factor for why we have this sexual marketplace. Now, I'm definitely an ideas guy on most cases, but not on this one. In this one, it's economic, and here's why. What happens is if you have a lot of people who are sexually active, you have inelastic demand for certain commodities. Family planning, contraception, antibiotics, all of those are now, and what's inelastic demand? It means a demand for a commodity that no matter how high the price goes, you still have to consume it. I mean, food is one, right? A gas for a car is another one. Now, prior to the modern sexual marketplace, this is not how people behaved. I mean, yeah, you had sailors, you had women in ports, and you had soldiers going on sprees in other countries. But these were exceptions. These were edge cases. You didn't happen in your own country, you know, to your own women, right? And so the question then becomes, well, who benefits? Cui bono? Well, a lot of people make a lot of money. You know, these industries are multi-billion dollar industries that supply the commodities that are required for a sexually active lifestyle in the modern West, which did not exist 100 years ago. Just none of it existed. And so people couldn't do it. They might have wanted to do it, but they couldn't, because the technology that needed to be in place, the commodities that needed to be in place, weren't there. That they are now, okay? And so there's this whole aspect of massive profit generation that occurs with this. Second of all, it this is where I'm indebted to E. Michael Jones. What it does is it embeds people in a system of control where you can't step outside of the system, because certain lifestyles or practices that you have only work within that system. So a different analogy would be in Frank Herbert's Dune. Baron Vladimir Harkonnen is able to control people by getting them to become drug addicts. And the idea is, you know, if they don't do his bidding, they don't get their shot, which means they go into shock. And so they're completely loyal to the Baron. They're never going to turn against them, because he's got them, you know, by something soft. The same goes with the sexual marketplace. Once you get enough people buying into this as like normal behavior that we're all doing, any radicalism is just gone. Poof. What do you can't. This is one of my critiques of the ecological or eco revolutionary types, because, you know, they want to have like free love in the woods. It ain't gonna happen. You need contraception. How are you gonna do that without factories? You know, you're gonna have to have antibiotics for STDs. How are you gonna have that without factories? You're not. You literally will not be able. The material conditions will not allow you to do that. So you have people with these weird ideas that you can have like hippy dippy free love without technology. You know, the radical environmentalist types. Well, they've been completely unsuccessful, in part because they have a view of what is possible that isn't possible. And so, yeah, so basically it's stupid. It creates a massive profit generation system, and it creates a control grid where people can't step outside of it without giving up a lot more than they're willing to. And so they just sort of grit their teeth and sit through it all.
And I mean, to some extent, you can actually see it happening in the past couple of weeks, where there's been this big push for regime change in Iran. And one of the messaging strands has been, well, do you know, like, those Iranian girls are kind of hot underneath the hijab. Why don't we, you know, liberate? They've been trying to, like, use it as a kind of, like, you get, I mean, I find it pretty disgusting, to be honest. Like, in this country, there's this Iranian guy called Meir Tuzi, right? And, I mean, it's literally cheering for OnlyFans for Iran, right? It's saying, like, well, look at this. How dare this one country try to stick to a more traditional line against the, you know, sex and drugs and rock and roll. They're being denied it, and therefore it's oppression. And this messaging all through the Cold War was pretty successful. I think of David Hasselhoff on the wall and things like this. One of the questions I've got, Todd, is, it does seem to play on something that people want, doesn't it? Right? It does seem to have, when you look at their revealed preferences, there are a lot of people at that concert at the wall. Or there are young women in Iran, say, who think that they're being oppressed because they're being denied Western-style feminism. Or if you talk to the average person about this issue in the West, in Britain, for example, their default line will be, it's wrong, like the mullahs are mainly wrong in Iran because they're oppressing women. And when you drill into that, it's, well, wearing a hijab, not having the same rights, and, you know, being denied easy divorces and things like this. as it happens, divorce laws in Iran are pretty quote unquote progressive from a certain lens, right? I.e., divorce does go on. So what do you do against this? Because it does seem to be quite like an irresistible corrosive acid, if you want to put it this way. It's a drug, but it's an addictive one, and it seems to like make people happy, or at least they think they are. So how do you come back on all of that?
Well, yeah, this also goes into during the Obama administration, the war in Afghanistan, France and Germany, who had initially opposed the broader war on terror, are getting on board now because it's fighting for feminist rights in Afghanistan, right? That's how they were able to spin it. So we can add to that control element, not that it just keeps you rooted in place, but it gets you to buy into imperial adventures that you otherwise wouldn't have bought into, right? And so I think the first thing that has to be stated is that there's so much, this cannot be understated. So much of modern life is only made possible by the invention of new technologies as commodities that did not exist 100 years ago. That if we were to realize this is the unusual, this is not the norm for humanity because the material conditions did not allow for it in the past. Sure, there were people that wished they could do it. Sure, there were some powerful men at the top that sort of got away with it. But these are really edge cases. And everybody more or less realized, well, we just can't do it because let's look at it this way. There's a whole galaxy of beliefs. You've got the sort of, you know, you said drug, sex, and rock and roll, which is the more hetero-coded, but you've also got homosexuality, transgenderism, easy divorce, you know, multiple partners, all of this bundled together as a part of a revolutionary battering ram within the West. Now, they want to look back on history and say, well, look, these people were just being repressive. And that we could have always done this at any point in human history. So they invent, you know, was it sun dawn at sunrise or something, where they were talking about how, you know, Stone Age peoples had free love, which is nonsense. They'd all be dead. STDs would have wiped these people out. And this is what people don't understand. Medication, antibiotics is crucial in keeping this going, because if you didn't have it, you got STD, you're going to die. And it's going to be a slow, painful death. And that's why a lot of people didn't do it in the past, because they knew what would happen. I mean, you could see guys that just, and prostitutes that just went out in a really bad way. And we just don't talk about that. And I'm sure there's externalities that we don't see today because it's hidden. Now, one of the things that the old left used to do, and even the new left, would expose the hidden social relations of capital. But what they've never done, and the left has never done, is exposed how the hidden relations of capital affect human sexuality in a capitalist country. And I find that to be very, very suspicious. It's very, very interesting. Why is it even the old left, even the left that wasn't, you know, a CIA front, you know, even they didn't do that. And that, to your point, that highlights how seductive this is as a selling point. But the problem is, it's just not possible without technology. And with technology, there are still externalities to it. So I think what needs to be just stated so clearly is that technology has radically changed how we can do this. And that what people think is normal and natural is only because we have a culture supported by law and technology and certain things that allow people to do this in a way that wouldn't be possible before.
So one of the things I want to get onto here, Todd, and it's hard to know how to pivot to this in a way, but I think it's important, is, I mean, one of the disturbing trends that I have seen on the online right is that a lot of the, how can I say, like once you start seeing some of the things that you're talking about, it starts to manifest as a real hatred of women, and especially of white women. For example, when that woman recently was shot by the ICE officer, regardless of what you make of that, a lot of people made weird posts. One of the ones that really caught my eye, I forget who it was now, said, oh, put a picture of this woman who'd just been shot by a government officer. And it said, oh, I feel like I've been condescended to by this woman my whole life. Okay. Now, rightly, a lot, I mean, lots of people liked that tweet and retweeted it. But a lot of people also dragged him and said, like, this is psycho, dude. What? Like, so because you've had issues with women, like, if she deserves to be shot or something, okay? And I had a couple of months ago started wondering what became of the Manosphere types, okay? What became? Because I think that had its heyday, like, about 10 years ago, okay? And some of them went on the trajectory of becoming kind of trads in some way. Was it Roosh? Or yeah, like they became Roosh. Married and they said, like, oh, I denounce my old ways and stop doing all of this. One of the blogs I came across, I don't know if you remember this guy, he's called GLO, or the Magic GLO. Have you come across this guy at all?
No.
And he brought out this book called The Pillars of Wisdom. In fact, so bizarre were the ideas of this GLO that I bought it. See if I can find it here. This book is called The Pillars of Wisdom. One of the most bizarre articles I've ever read in my entire life is by this chap, GLO, okay? And I'll just share it on my screen here, okay? He says, white women make sex gay. And I'll just read you a little bit of this, and I won't read it all. I'll just read you a little bit. He says, Substack is flooded with articles about sex. It all missed the most critical point about sex in the contemporary era. White women make sex so gay that nobody wants to have sex with white women anymore. Men would rather jerk off all over themselves to videos of white women having sex rather than actually having sex with white women. Because deep down inside, they know that if they were actually to slide their pants down and have sex with a white woman, she would make it incredibly and unbearably gay. And then he goes on and on, right? But the upshot of this thesis of GLOs is that he starts advocating for really bizarre things. For example, he argues that because in the current marketplace, white women have become so unbearable that as the kind of, sensitive young man or whatever, you should make it a point to only have sex with Oriental women or Middle Eastern women or non-white women, essentially. Okay. And then he argues that if you do have sex with white women, you must make sure that you don't do it normally. That you actually do it the other way. You understand what I'm saying? Like you actually make it gay sex to make a point of it. And in fact, even in this article, he says, look, if you are going to do it, you should actually show her a video of you having sex normally with a non-white woman, but then make a point of only having anal sex with her. Okay, this stuff is fucking weird, Todd. Right? It's really weird. What's going on? Because even if there's a grain of a point, like what the men, like, surely this is not the answer. This is gone off into weird, like weird, almost perverse territory. So, I mean, I don't know if you have any comment on any of that
stuff. Well, yeah. So let's start with this is a symptom of a broader problem. So I might get the French wrong here, but Michelle Houellebecq, who wrote Elementary Particles, writes about how the class hierarchy of capitalism distorts the sexual marketplace. So that if you're near the top, you get quote unquote all the action. If you're at the bottom, you get nothing. And so the first thing is these are, we might call sexual proletarians. These are guys that are just at the bottom. And because it's a marketplace, if you don't have money, you can't get in unless you're a good con man. And you know, okay, that's a different angle altogether. So we can call them sexual proletarians. And, you know, they're living in this digital bubble, because I'm guessing this guy's younger, maybe millennial, Zoomer, maybe. But the idea then is it creates everybody has a distorted expectation. So you could read in the past about an emperor that had a harem and had, you know, 5,000 wives and concubines. That kind of expectation, everybody knew, like, okay, look, most people aren't going to get that. The emperor might, okay, maybe, but like most people just aren't. But now, because of this distorted marketplace, as Houellebecq talks about, you now have people that believe it is a realistic expectation. And then the people at the top who come closest to getting it, whether they do or not, are incentivized to say that they do, because that helps their position within the marketplace. And so we have a lot of distorted marketplace expectations where people are either not telling you accurately what they're doing, or they're coping, or they're overcompensating for being at the bottom of the marketplace so that they don't get these things, right? And so all of these expectations for what is normal are completely opposite of what any, you know, prior human civilization would have thought, because they would have known that, no, these are just not really attainable goals. Why would you even think it was attainable, right? See, part of the problem is, and this also explains why, you know, you have a lot of guys that have that kind of experience with white women as well, where everybody coming into this market has a set of expectations that are false on two levels. They're false that these are, you know, prior to technology, prior to our modern society, humans didn't really have these expectations, you know, except in very few edge cases, like an emperor with a harem or something, right? Or a sailor with a woman in every port. And then you have the expectations of what the marketplace says it can give you. And that's false as well. It doesn't actually give you that. Because, right, the argument was, well, look, the old way of doing things, the traditional, the conservative way, the Christian way, you know, doesn't give you the sort of, you know, connection, intimacy that you want, right? And if you want true love, you know, you've got to break all these rules. Now, we offer you this magical marketplace that allows you to do that. Well, it turns out the marketplace was just there to make money, had nothing to do with making you happy, had nothing to do with giving you connection and intimacy. It's just there to make money. And so everybody's going in there saying, well, why am I not getting the results that I paid for? Well, because that was never the point of the market. And that creates a distortion for everybody involved. And I think now with the manosphere, you said, you know, they tapped out, their peak was about 10 years ago. You know, where have they gone? Well, I mean, they throw it in the towel, right? I mean, you've got Aaron Clary's The Menu, right? You master female psychology so well that you realize you just aren't going to have a future with them anymore. That's sort of the rip manosphere, right? And so the idea then is, what was the whole point? Well, I think much of the manosphere was just manipulating vulnerable men to get money from them. They didn't actually tell them, you know, how to look. I mean, look, when one of the lead guys says, look, you know, the rest of your life is not going to have a woman in it, or vice versa, you're a woman with no man. Well, then what did you actually learn? I thought you learned how to crack psychology. I thought you learned how to crack the code. But you tell me that after doing all that, there's no future. That sounds a lot more like a business venture than an actual psychological investigation of male and female behavior.
So, I mean, why don't we go through some of the responses to the current issue that you're talking about? Because, I mean, okay, the manosphere, even within the manosphere, there was men going their own way. If you remember, that was a whole movement at one point. There was another one, which was, you can crack female psychology to the extent that you can, even if you're married, kind of make that woman submit to your will in some way, or set down codes and laws and things like this, okay? Despite the fact, of course, a lot of the progressive laws are set up against men to do this sort of stuff, they were still kind of selling a rule book for how to, like, discipline women and things like this. So there's definitely a literature that exists around this. I remember I talked to a guy, was his name Ryan Stone? But I don't know, there's guys out there who write books along these lines. Then there was that guy from Eton. It kind of does a line in this as well, sort of. Then there is the Andrew Tate, who's selling a dream. I happened to watch Andrew Tate the other day, and in fact, I was thinking of even making a video on him. But basically, his dream, he sells the vision of, this world is buggered. He sees the Matrix. He sees all the power, manipulations, and so on. And he says, look, your only way out is to get FU money, buy a massive yacht, smoke cigars, and get all the honeys, get the harem, okay? As if you're an exceptional guy, you can't be tamed. This is the only thing you can do. This is what capitalism gives you, basically. So he sells that dream, which is the same basic dream as we mentioned before that the rappers sell. This is also like the message of a lot of hip hop, or it was at one point. You know, you can become a rapper or an NFL star, and then you can live a fast life strategy, I guess you'd say, till your heart's content. You've got all the money and all the women. and you can shag them and chuck them. Okay. Then the opposite of that, and they work almost in a tandem now, is the total incel line, which is strongly associated now with Nick Fuentes, which is, look, even if you've got money and even if you've got fame and so on, they just choose to opt out. In the end, like, just not going to have anything to do with it. I'm just going to stay a virgin, all the rest of it. I don't know if that is exactly the Fuentes line, but it exists as a kind of ideology. For some reason, the mainstream media, certainly in this country, is kind of obsessed with incels. They see them as a real issue. What can you give me some sort of assessment of these ways of reacting in your view, and are any of them helpful at all?
Well, I'll say this. The black pill community, the incel community, even the MGTOW community, and people like Nick, who all basically agree we just walk away. Now, the MGTOW aren't necessarily incels or V-cells or whatever, but all these groups share the idea that we need to walk away. It reminds me of that line from that 1980s film called War Game, if you ever saw it, where there's an AI computer that's going to nuke the world. And so then they ask him to run all these scenarios to see what's the winning move against the Soviets. And of course, the whole world gets blown up, every single scenario. And it says the only winning move is not to play. How about a game of chess? And that's what those guys are doing. It's a strike. The sexual proletariat are going on strike. Now, you know, do they know they're doing that? Do they? Is it like, it's sort of like, let's use a class analysis here. It's a class identity that isn't fully crystallized. And as you could say that Nick Fuentes maybe is serving the role of a vanguard here. Some of the MGTOW authors might have been vanguards as well, where they say, look, this, just walk away. Right now, that I think is a very serious threat to the system, because it means that they're not going to buy in. And to make this even more spicy, the original Marxist revolutionaries were incels like that. Mao Zedong, prior to becoming God Emperor of China in 1946, was an incel. And a lot of these guys were like, look, if we're gonna win, to get the women we want, we got to overthrow the whole system. And the same goes in the Russian Revolution. A lot of these guys, they were either married, so very like traditional, or they just were, you know, having no relations with women whatsoever. You can read about that in The Fire in the Minds of Men by Billington. We talk about anarchists and socialists. Yes, that is the dynamite that blows up an order with revolutionary potential. So I could see why you'd be afraid of that. Now, the other thing then is there's...
Sorry, again. You see, this is the Marx line. You like can't, you know, you don't choose when you were born. I was a teenager in the 90s, Todd. Right? Kind of like, how can I put this? Having known the sexual marketplace, I'll just put it this way: women just aren't going to care, though, are they? Are they really like? Because I was just striking it, like. But let's be honest. Let's just pretend I became an incel, right? Let's pretend I walked away from did a MGTOW, walked my own path, and I said, I forswear all women. I know, and this is not a kick in my own ego, I just know women as a group just aren't going to care. They're just not going to care. They're going to be like, oh, this guy doesn't want to, all right, so what? I didn't want to go with you anyway. Do you know what I mean? Like, how is it a I struggle to see how it's a severe blow, because most of the women just aren't going to care. They're just going to laugh.
Well, okay, so let's look at this from a few angles here. First of all, from the point of view of those who are in power, the elites, a large group of disaffected young men, disaffected for exactly that reason, are a revolutionary threat. That's where Mao came out of. That's where the Bolsheviks and the other revolutionaries came out of. They were coming out of this, not every single one, but it was a demographic that they were utilizing to fuel the revolution. So it's political, not sexual. Now, that's a very real concern. But then you've also got the more establishment type people who are like what we would today call the middle class. And if you are, you know, a man that they think should have settled down and you don't, they get nervous, they get upset, they get concerned. And again, these are older people, you know, established people, middle class people. Now, your personal experience talking about, you know, the 90s, I think there's a difference though now where women will begin to see this as a threat. As we enter the demographic winter, the demographic crisis, they are going to have less options too, because there's just fewer people, in this case, men, to go around. Now, they'll be downstream from all these other concerns, right? But I think, though, that from the point of view of the political establishment, this is dangerous. It's not revolutionary yet. It's proto-revolutionary. It's that kind of demographic, if the right vanguard leader went to them, could activate that base just like Mao did.
I remember on this specific point, I remember reading a book years ago by Matt Ridley. I think it was called The Evolution of Everything. Now, Matt Ridley is a libertarian. He's kind of progressive, kind of pro-democracy. And he's basically defending the end of history, saying, like, we've got the perfect, like, this is the evolution of everything. So he sees capitalism, quote unquote, as an evolutionary, like, our current configuration is the evolution of, as the kind of logical endpoint of all of human experience, things like this. One of the chapters in there is on marriage, the institution of marriage. And he says, look, they tried the Sultan system in some parts of the world where the men at the top get all the women and you get a large group of incels who are locked out of the sexual marketplace. And he says, look, this historically is very dangerous because once they're denied sex for long enough, that anger and energy needs to go somewhere, and they end up overthrowing the Sultan or violently revolting against the Sultan. And, you know, Christianity sorted this problem out from an evolutionary perspective by essentially giving men who would not be able to get women in a true kind of free market because they would gravitate upwards to the Sultan, okay, essentially by allocating women to those men, so that in theory, that would mean that they wouldn't be locked out of sex, and therefore they don't rise up in rebellion. So this is Matt Ridley's argument in defense, I guess, of the Christian institution of marriage, okay? Is that true? Do you think that's, like, if you get enough concentration of men who are locked out of sex, that eventually they're just gonna, you know, rise up in violent rebellion? Is that really the case?
Yeah, I think that is the case. Now, one of the ways Islam dealt with that was expansion, right? Those men became the jihadis that could then claim war brides. But when the Islamic empires were unable to expand as rapidly as they were in the past, it does end up turning inward. But if we look at, say, both the Russian and Chinese revolutions, this is actually the real world example that we're talking about. These are the guys that were either at the bottom, locked out completely, or lower nobility who were not, you know, the overproduction of elites. They weren't in the hierarchy they thought they should be in. And they then utilized that. I guess we could invoke, what's his name? Wilhelm Reich now, an orgone. they harnessed the orgone of all these incels and then overthrew the system. That can actually happen. Now, we don't actually have a Lenin or a Mao or any revolutionary leader who could do that yet. But if you're in the elite, you don't want to wait around. That's something that you don't want to have happen. But also, too, though, with the guys that are selling the harem fantasy, they're doing something, too, this reinforces the elite. Because one is it gets you to consume. And of course, that means they profit off of you then, right? If we envision a sort of like traditional Christian quiverful family where they don't use contraception, they're not really making money off you. They're not. Your sex life is not commodified anymore. It's outside of the scope of the market. Whereas the vision that like the hip hop artists and Andrew Tate sell, you're in again. They're making lots of money off you. Because of the lifestyle you've chosen to live needs the commodities that they sell you. Now, that means they also own you, not just because they profit off of you, but you're not going to bite the hand that feeds you. If you get used to that kind of lifestyle, you're not going to act in any way that jeopardizes it, which means that reinforces loyalty to the system. And then thirdly, you know, a lot of these guys, it's never going to happen. It's a fantasy. So what it does, though, is it keeps people who might be a threat, men who could be a threat, in this sort of like trance. It's like a spell. It's like a wizard casting a spell, a charm spell, if you will. And so they don't see the situation that they're in, right? There's that old saying, Americans see themselves as temporarily embarrassed billionaires. And so what Andrew Tate is saying is you're a temporarily embarrassed sultan. You know, you could be a sultan like me. Of course, that's not going to happen. That's just a scam. But so all of this has primarily economic and political angles that really are what matters. And everything else is just kind of a fluff piece that gets you to ignore the realities of the situation.
What about the other response to this, which I guess you'd call is the trad response, right? I mean, I've got friends, associates who have this response who say like, look, okay, we see all of this. I mean, in a sense, F. Roger Devlin comes out on this side of things as well. His book, was it Sex and Utopia? Or the Sex...
I have never read him.
But, I mean, F. Roger Devlin sees a lot of the stuff that you're talking about. You know, he's not really up for the free love stuff. He's not really up for feminism and all that sort of stuff. But he says, look, even despite all of this, you have to, in the end, come down on the side of marriage, even if it's difficult, even if it's the odds are stacked against you, you know, you still have to try to make it work. And a lot of trads and a lot of trad caths and so on come out on this side of things. And okay, it comes sometimes with a bit of virtue signaling. This is the way it works in my marriage, or I am able to live the kind of patriarch lifestyle or whatever, you know. What do you make of this response? I mean, as I watch things online, this group, the trads, fight a lot with the Nick Fuentes crowd. They fight a lot with the Andrew Tate types. And they also fight, I mean, another group who've pushed kind of anti-women lines are the Baptists, Bronze Age Pervert in particular, and his friends. You know, they call women foids. They, they call women roasties. They're always down on the notion of marriage. You know, in some cases, they low-key promote homosexuality, right? But they point out all the problems with marrying women. You know, one of the phrases that crowd like to use is they talk about, she's run through. Why you were marrying this run through, you know, your trad wife is run through and you're just getting here as kind of almost as a cuckold at the end of the line type thing. But I see this argument play out sporadically, often when there's not a lot of news or whatever, people go back to this sort of stuff. What do you have to say to all of this?
Well, I think the first thing to say is with the trad position, where you see a lot of the pushback. For example, there was a debate between Black Horse and Red Hawk about, you know, this question, trad versus PUA. And one of the things that the PUAs always say is, you know, you don't understand the time that we're living in. One, that's true, but it's also true of the PUAs. They also don't understand. See, part of why this is important is by defining the market, by describing its inputs, by describing the way it operates, the way it's intended to operate by those who created it, it contextual. See, all of these different groups are trying to explain what is going on, why are we here? And they're all doing it in a way that is completely devoid of any understanding of economics and class. And so that, I think, is one of the key reasons why they fail in succeeding in any way that they want. So with the trad example, one of the reasons why they fail is they don't understand why these changes have occurred. So, for example, Ultimately, yes, Roe v. Wade was repealed in the Supreme Court level. But one of the reasons why feminism was so ensconced and why things like abortion and contraception and everything else were just basically subsidized by the U.S. government is because the economy would collapse. If half the workforce went home, aka women, it would collapse the economy. And so the reason why this was tolerated and pushed was in order to create a cheap labor market. You double the workforce, supply and demand, cost gets cut in half. Once you've done that, you can't walk it back without crashing the economy. So that's like the meta reason, right? And then you've got like the individual reasons. So if you are a woman in the workforce, even now, right, all of these things are still true. You might even want to go back to the trad life. We see this on social media and YouTube and elsewhere, but they can't because the economy is not set up so that you can do that. And these people that, quote, make it, it's survivorship bias. So the trads that actually pull it off, there's a whole bunch of things that went right in their lives that they don't talk about, that most people don't. And that's because the system, see, we're all betting against the system to one degree or another. The system isn't working for us. And so those people were able to get certain leg up in spite of the system. And, you know, I'm not saying good for you, fine, but like, don't pretend that you didn't get there in spite of the system because of other people's help. The system is set up so that these things can't happen. And so they don't, unless you work very intentionally to make it happen. So that's what I'd say to the trads. And then with some of these other, you know, critiques from the outside, I would just reiterate my point that when you buy into this sort of like, whether it's BAP, right, or Andrew Tate or any of this, these sort of edgy non-standard views of sexuality that aren't, well, they're not liberal, but they're not, you know, traditional conservative Christian either. What you're doing is you're still buying into the system because it's a way to sort of capture that element. The other thing too, I'm just going to go a little out there and say that this whole thing is also harvesting what Wilhelm Reich called orgone, a kind of sexual energy that is latent in human beings. And it harvests it because the obvious way you harvest it is you monetize it, right? You stoke it up and then you get people to go to the clubs and then they pay you money. So you're harvesting this energy that you're controlling. It's like a controlled industrial process at the meta level, which most of us are just completely unaware of.
I mean, just to push back a little bit, you mentioned that neither the PUAs nor the trads understand the economics of it. If Red Hawk was here, I'm sure, because he comes from that sort of background, he would say, no, Todd, the PUA position is built on top of an understanding of economics. And we've done the calculations and we figured out that marriage, if for the modern guy, I mean, I don't know if this is still Red Hawk's position, but Red Hawk from a few years ago would have said these sorts of things. He would have said, well, we've done the calculations. Men throughout history were compensated with a dowry for getting married. Now it's not worth it. So we've done the economic calculations, and the optimum way in this system is to play the field because, you know, it's a bum deal. Basically, they've made it a bum deal. So how would you come back on that sort of, you know, this is the Aaron Clary thing, or who's the other one? Tomasi, that's it.
Yeah, so what I would say is, okay, if you're looking at this market, this problem, this civilizational crisis, from the point of view of an individual, i.e. yourself, who's doing a cost-benefit analysis to everything that you're choosing to do in life, I would not disagree and say that you didn't do that. I believe them when they say they did it. But what I'm saying is, when you look at the actual marketplace, because they're talking about the marketplace, and nobody's getting the marketplace right, because we're not talking about individual cost-benefit analysis on what you should do right now vis-a-vis the options you have. What I'm saying is, the marketplace gives you a set of expectations and ideals and dreams, which are all completely fake. They only exist to hide the fact that this is making them a lot of money. And then that also that it's a control mechanism to keep you invested in the system rather than leaving. So you know, for example, a Taliban fighter is a threat because he's not a part of that system. He's not going to go in for the Andrew Tate dream. And then also the incel sexual proletariat are a revolutionary core that could and I think will develop at some point. It's like a bunch of explosives under your house. You don't want anybody to light that fuse. And we see what happens when you do. Russia, 1917, and China in the 19, you know, from the 20s to the 40s. And so there's that. And ultimately, the reason why the expectations are so mismatched is we were just lied to. None of the things that the free expression crowd from the 60s and 70s talked about was real. It was just to get people to become captive to this commercial system and keep consuming these products with inelastic demand in order to stay in control. And the thing that was my real breakaway moment here is I thought to myself, Marxists and socialists have never done this. Why? Because it's obvious. Once you look at this problem, only Michelle Houellebecq has even, as far as I can tell, talked about this, how capitalism distorts the sexual marketplace and creates basically proletarians and bourgeoisie of sex. And so that's the economics that the right doesn't get. We're living in a system where we have the sexual bourgeoisie like Andrew Tate and then sexual proletariat like the incels. And so there was a Marxist YouTuber guy like 10 years ago I was watching, and he was saying, you know, we're going to have gay space luxury communism. And, you know, he was a Q&A question section, and some guy said, do you think that the incel epidemic is the result of capitalism? And this guy said, no, it's a you issue. He went full Jordan Peterson. Like, no, you are a Marxist. It's literally by definition a capitalist problem. And that was really struck me. Why would a Marxist not say this? And I think it's because that mode of analysis, the right won't use it because, well, you know, Marxist is bad. So that's self-explanatory. But why the left won't use it, that's a little bit harder to explain. Because once you do that, you can't unsee it. Once you expose the hidden social relations of capital in the sexual marketplace and how this all feeds in on itself, you just can't unsee it.
So you mentioned Houellebecq there, and one of the things I've been wondering about as you've been talking is that it's like, okay, well, yeah, I mean, the incel revolution may come, may not come. But it strikes me as, you know, if you zoom out a little bit, that situation can't persist for that long. Because, you know, the more I mean, it's a cliche to say the more people talk about sex, the less they're actually having it. I think young people are having less sex than ever before. You know, every once in a while, there's a newspaper article that says this. I mean, one thing that could happen is the revolution. But what if the thing that happens is that these people just don't, all of these people you're talking about, men and women, don't reproduce. Other groups do reproduce. And, I mean, wasn't this the topic of Houellebecq's submission? That essentially, you know, this is how Islam ends up taking over France or whatever, because it's the only way to reproduce or the only way to, you know, I mean, is this not another scenario? I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm just saying, like, logically, that situation of incels and women not having sex with each other and not reproducing and not having families, that's like a one generation and you're done thing. You can't have too many generations of that. It cannot reproduce itself. So what's the answer to this?
No, I would agree that is another possibility as well, that this problem is not solved, and that the civilizations that persist with this sexual marketplace just go extinct. That's also possible. No, so when I'm talking about the quote revolution, I don't mean an incel revolution, but I mean a revolution that harnesses the incel's potential, promising them rewards after the revolution. That's what the elites are afraid of. It doesn't mean it's going to happen. And I think that's why they run guys like Tate. They run guys like Tate in order to bring them back in, to not let that happen. Now, there are members of the elite who I think are concerned about the broader demographic crisis, and that's, you know, someone like Elon Musk, right? The more realpolitik crowd, the national security state crowd, because you need to have soldiers in your military, and you want to have soldiers if you don't reproduce, right? So they're beginning to slowly sort of realize that that wing is not the blue Democrat wing. They still won't admit this.
But hasn't one of the dominant responses of the elite been, right, well, if white people aren't going to reproduce, we'll just get in the people who will? Indians,
yes.
Pakistanis, South Americans, just people who will reproduce.
Right. That has been their solution. But ultimately, if we take, this is where I've criticized the right on the narrowness of their perspective on the demographic crisis. The demographic crisis is worldwide. China's projected to lose something like 400 million people by 2050, just due to aging, just like the rest of the world. And so that is just a Band-Aid, because ultimately all the other countries around the world that the United States has been importing these people from are also suffering varying degrees of demographic crisis. And if you siphon those people off from their home country, that's going to accelerate the decline of the home country, because they also need those people to reproduce in their countries, not in the United States, right? It's a Band-Aid solution, because the real problem is we have a set of incentive structures that make it very, very hard for people to pair bond and reproduce. That's the problem. And the sexual marketplace is the manifestation of that problem.
I mean, I would like the population to go down. I've said that on multiple occasions. Would it be the worst thing?
Well, I guess the question then becomes going down or extinction, because some groups will probably go extinct. They'll probably just not. I mean, look at any reading of ancient history. All these tribes are gone, right? The Illyrians, the Galatians, the Libyans, the Gauls, the Britons. They've all been either absorbed into other nations or just gone extinct. And that's a possibility. And I guess, that's what some people might be okay with that. Some of the more anti-human environmentalist types might be like, that's great. But for a lot of us, I don't think we want extinction. Now, I don't think it will actually get to extinction for all of humanity, but there will be groups that are selected against. And in the sense, that will be good, because it represents a sort of like moral or intelligence test. Like, are you able to rise above these moral hazards in order to do this? And if you can't, well, maybe you shouldn't survive.
I mean, Ed Dutton has got a more brutal eugenicist line on this sort of stuff. I mean, I think he published a whole book along these lines, I forgot what it's called now, where he says, look, if all the blue-haired feminists and the LGBT and the left, the spiteful mutants, as he calls them, don't reproduce, that's great. It means that they will extinguish themselves from the gene pool, okay? But expanding his thesis a little bit, what's not to say that the incels that you're talking about are also not spiteful mutants?
Well,
who will just expand themselves from the gene pool also?
That is a possibility. And the question then becomes, well, at a certain point when the demographic crisis becomes extreme enough, you can't really be too picky about who reproduces, because it's either reproduce or die. So in one sense, when the crisis gets so advanced, you can't be very picky. But in an absolute sense, and like, okay, if we did this right sense, there is, I think, a tendency where those people that are terminally online can also be deleterious in, you know, their own ways. And so then the question is, what's going to happen? But I think it's getting so bad that, you know, the ironic or unthinkable union of an incel and a feminist might be, you know, the last barrier before nothing.
Right. All right. Well, interesting. Very interesting, Todd. And you have as always, you have a unique perspective on this sort of thing. I'll be honest, I don't know what to think about all of these sorts of things in general. I see a lot of as always, I'm put off by chud rage, right? I don't like to see, misogyny is not the right word. I mean, I've been called a misogynist more times than I can, you know, I've always been called a misogynist by women. Not true, by the way, if you're watching any women. But I do see an uglier kind of side to it where, you know, like, how can I put it? Karen, you know, disliking white women as a class and this sort of thing strikes me as unhealthy on a civilizational level. It's not healthy for people to have such negative views about their own women. Do you know what I mean? I don't know what the answer is, but I feel like that is not a, not positive in a way. Then again, maybe you're right, and it something like that needs to happen to break the deadlock. I don't know, but it seems like, I mean, people talk about entropy and things like that. I always remember Spengler got this line somewhere. It's like, if it becomes a question, it's already over. You know, if like, the question of reproducing is even discussed, this is a terminal, like civilizational sickness. But yeah, I mean, part of me just thinks like, look, if you're engaging in this sort of thing and you genuinely have such hatred in your heart for your fellow human beings because they've got different politics to you or because they're a woman or something, you know, there's a line of thought that's like somebody else is winning. You know, yesterday we talked about, you know, how division, divide and rule, divide and conquer. And if you're able to divide people to the extent where you're dividing husbands and wives or potential husbands and wives, isn't somebody else winning in that scenario?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the winners, there's broadly two kinds of winners, right? There's the economic system, which makes a lot of money off this, right? All the things you just talked about have are there's an economic reality around it that they profit off of, right? Again, happy Christian couple with a lot of kids not using contraception, you're not going to make a lot of money off that. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. We know rage sells because social media would have all these rage bait articles in order to get people to keep clicking and keep eyes on the screen. And then we also know, you know, the political control, divide and conquer, right? So these, if you're, you know, Abraham Lincoln and Jesus Christ said a house divided against itself cannot stand. There, you know, you're talking about the individual soul or the nation, but you can also be talking about a family, right? If a husband and wife are divided against each other, they can't stand. And that's also part of a control mechanism as well to keep, well, it's like what the labor organizers say, right? If you're fighting the worker across the table, you're not fighting the boss above you.
Fascinating. I mean, my economics brain kicks in and says, well, look, if you're running the system, you've got to think, like, what is the bigger GDP boon? Is it men and women buying contraceptive pills and condoms and dildos? Or is it the sheer cost of a child? Because, I mean, my daughter's six now, but I remember, you know, when she was a baby, reading all these stats about, like, you know, all of the diapers, you Americans call it, nappies, we call it in this country, but, you know, just the cost of, like, all of the stuff, the clothes, a child is also an economic boon and viewed purely economically, a pure consumer who does nothing but consume. And I'd be interested to see what the bigger kind of gain is to GDP. Is it the cost of a child? Or is it the cost of all of the sex paraphernalia that you're talking about?
Well, the cost wouldn't be borne by the establishment, right? It would be borne by the mother and, you know, by extension, possibly the husband. And that's a choice they make because they're not going to profit directly from this. So that's why they defer, right? It's not really a decision that's made. It's made in an ecosystem created by the elites, yes, but yeah. It's not a decision the elites make. But also, too, the elites, it kind of reminds me of, which spaghetti western was it? I think it was the second Dollars trilogy where the opening line says, in a land where life has no value, death has a price. And that's kind of where we're living right now.
Right. I mean, what I'm thinking of, like pure nickels and cents, the money that you, the thousands of pounds you spend on clothes and on, you know, baby solution and baby food and all this sort of stuff is going, it's still going to Johnson & Johnson, Unilever, and what's that company called? I tried to boycott them once, which is what got me along these lines. Procter & Gamble, you know, they're still generating thousands and thousands of pounds from parents as a consumer class. So it's just something I wonder about, whether it's kind of, could it even be short-sighted? If it's a market thing, is it short-sighted to try to sell this? Because ultimately, you have three kids. Those three kids then grow up to become consumers down the line. Kind of end up being economically better for the system. And the parents that become not revolutionaries, but taxers and grillers. Grillers who get taxed. Watching the sports ball, all that stuff, you know?
Well, I think when the sexual marketplace was constructed in the post-war period, because of the baby boom, I think the expectation was population would keep going up. The intentional downward pressure on population growth didn't really come from the market. It came from political sources, you know, people who were afraid of overpopulation and things like that. So I think what we're seeing here is a political incentive, a political pressure entering into the market, if you will, distorting the market. And so, yeah, because I think when the sexual marketplace was created, to your point, I think they did think it would just keep growing. But the growth is due to the degrowth is due to two things: these external political pressures, and then also the fact that we're living in this, you know, Welbeckian pyramid where you have the sexual proletariat and the sexual bourgeoisie, and then the inner logic of the market just makes it harder and harder for people to play the game because you need to have capital to play.
Fascinating. All right, Todd, well, where can people find you? And have you done any other videos on this sort of thing? I remember you did one on the trans question. We didn't even get into trans today.
No, we didn't. Well, you can find me at PF Podcast on X. You can find me on YouTube at Praise of Valley Podcast. I would recommend the trans video. I might have done one other video on this topic, but no more than two I can think of.
I mean, just to not leave people hanging, I mean, the basic idea, if I can remember, of the trans video is to say that trans as a phenomena, as a kind of cultural phenomena, is a capitalist phenomenon. They didn't have, I mean, okay, there are lady boys in Bangkok, and, you know, there would have been people who had sex changes in Iran and probably even in the Soviet Union as well. But as a kind of cultural issue on the scale that we have it now, I think it's overstated, by the way, but the fact that it's a thing, you argue, comes from capitalism or the capitalist system.
Yeah. So to sum it up briefly, what it is the trans identity is a product of late stage capitalism, where sexual identity has been completely commodified in order to divert any sort of revolutionary potential that individual might have had into an identity that is entirely manufactured and fabricated by capital.
Interesting. All right, so yeah, check out Todd on Praise of Folly YouTube channel. It will be linked in the show notes as ever. I'll remind people, I mean, Lord knows what Shakespeare may have made of all of this. Funny enough, there's a lot of cross-dressing in Shakespeare. There were no women on Shakespeare's stage. Shakespeare himself may have been bisexual. So there is all of that sort of stuff, but as always, it's very difficult to read our current time back into that time. They didn't even have those categories of gay and straight and so on. They were thinking in a very different way back then. That's a topic for another day. This has been fascinating, Todd. Just, you know, possibly a bit blackpilling as well. I don't know. I honestly don't know what to make of these issues. And in a way, whenever I talk about these things, I'm glad to be a man of 43 and not a man of 23, because I just don't know what I do now. I really don't. But anyway, pick up a course at the academic agency. Do you know, on this topic, I always remember somebody left me a review once. I don't talk about reviews I get. Somebody sent me an email saying, look, I did Foundations of Writing, and it helped me get a date. Because... right? They were on one of these dating sites, and the woman wrote back and said, "It's so nice to see somebody write in proper sentences." And so this guy emailed me and said, "Thanks, AA. That was because of you." Pick up foundations of writing, and you too could be the king of the sexual marketplace. Promo code SHORJAN, and I'll see you tomorrow.
See ya.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.